the buzzer, McCord on its way.
Oh my goodness!
They have to get it. With no timeouts, they do.
Courtside with Greenberg and Dokic, the definitive college basketball podcast.
Upstart. Hey, welcome to the world's greatest podcast, a.k.a. Courtside with Greenberg and Dokic. You know, two curmudgeon-y guys. One of the two of us always are going to have an opening rant, so I defer to you, Seth Greenberg. What are you running hot on?
Well, first of all, here's a couple things. Number one, you can really see who can coach and who can't coach in football because, like, Nick Saban, they couldn't guard anyone at the beginning of the season. They couldn't stop Lane Kiffin and all that spread offense stuff. And now, like, they're monsters. I mean, Mississippi State couldn't move a yard. Number two is I'm going to go back on my man Dan Mullen. One week he wants 91,000 people in the swamp because he lost to Texas A&M. And he was like a little guy, a little kid. Complain, I want 91,000 people in the swamp because we need a home field. And then he's played Missouri. His guy took a bad shot at the end of the half. He runs out on the field. It creates chaos. Then I have no problem with him firing up the crowd. Here's what I got a problem with. You fire up the crowd, then you go in the tunnel, then you come back out. Like, it, what is this, like World WWE wrestling or something? And then you do it, like, go in and coach your team. Shut up and go in your coaching team. I'm like, dude, you're the head coach of Florida. You're the head coach at the Florida Gators. Like, bop, bop, bop. Spurrier, throw your visor down. Like, that's a big-time job. Can you please act like you're the head coach at Florida? I mean, like, Florida's a big-time job. Yeah, okay, your guy, your Trask, there was a bad shot taken on him. That happens all the time. All right? The official missed it. That's fine. And people, please do me a favor. Don't compare that to me getting thrown out of Cameron Indoor Stadium. All right? We were down 100 points. All right? You know, I mean, it was our first game in Cameron. You know, the whistle wasn't great. All right? I was standing up. That's totally a different thing. I mean, it was a melee. I'm interested to see what the SEC does today. Like, does the SEC have the, you know what, to come down and say, you know what, this is an embarrassment. With everything that's going on, this is an embarrassment to our league. And not a major rant, just a mini rant. Not close to your rant last week, which was epic, by the way. But I mean, like Dan Mullen, you were the head coach of Mississippi State. You are now the head coach of the great Florida Gators. It is a big difference. Carry yourself like a pro.
I always thought that every coach in college and high school and prep basketball genuflected at the altar of the great Don Meyer, and who said, make the big time where you are. What difference does it make if he's at Florida or Mississippi State? If you deem it to be embarrassing, then it's embarrassing. And I got a problem with you, pal, by the way.
Okay.
I threw a sock at the TV the other day. Justin Turner did nothing wrong. Justin Turner was, hey, look, you work your lifetime to become a World Series.
Oh.
Yeah, they tell you, look, they tell you you've got some disease. It's in his age group is 99.98% survivable. Okay, his manager, Dave Roberts, has cancer. He wanted him out there. Everybody wanted him out there. He'd been out there for 7 hours with him, but pregame, during the game. Now, all of a sudden, he's supposed to not.
Oh, we're going to change protocol because they won the world championship. We're going to change protocol.
When I was a sophomore in Indiana, I was playing baseball. And we had won the Big Ten in basketball. So in between games of a doubleheader, I was supposed to get on my bike, ride from the baseball field. We were playing Michigan, I think, and go down to Assembly Hall and take a picture to be in the team picture for the Big Ten champions. And I'm like, yeah, I don't know if I'm doing it. I'm getting ready to start the second game here. But I said, no, I want to be when my kids are older. I want to be in a picture in the Assembly Hall and show them. Justin Turner worked his whole life to be there. He worked his entire life. And oh, by the way, old curmudgeon guys didn't whine and moan it on Mike and Mike. You know who I didn't hear? The players, the Dodgers. Not one Dodger whined and moaned. But us old curmudgeons, we get on TV and we saw. I threw a sock at the TV when you were on with Jay, Will, and Zubin and them. I threw a sock.
I called into the show because you know what? You can't just pick and choose when you're going to follow protocol. You can't pick and choose when you're going to be responsible. You know what? What stopped him from celebrating? So he's going to be on the field. What? So that lasts, what, 20, 30 minutes?
That's it. And the life, and the pictures and the feeling last a lifetime. And, oh, by the way, last I looked, everybody seems to be doing okay that came into contact with him. 99.98 survival in his age group.
Okay, Clay Travis. No problem.
Just saying. That's what
all right.
It was.
Hey, and by the way, let's
talk about bad teammate. Hey, I did. I had a sock next to the bed. I rolled it up. And I said, yeah.
All right, here's my next. We were talking football a little bit and other sports. All right. First of all, Indiana football school. Besides that. All right. Harbaugh. He makes $8 million a year, right? Now, Michigan State, you know what? They're paying that coach to beat Michigan. He got it done. I mean, they went from losing to Rutgers to beat Michigan. How crazy and bad a situation is it in Ann Arbor to lose to Michigan State when you're in this stage of your program for Harbaugh as a Big Ten guy?
Seth, let's make no bones about this. Jim Harbaugh was brought there to beat Ohio State. He was brought there to elevate Michigan to national title contender. He was literally brought there to compete against Urban Meyer. I mean, let's just, you call it what it is. Urban got to Ohio State. He elevated the recruiting. He elevated the league's recruiting. Jim Harbaugh was brought in to do it. And frankly, he hasn't done it. And you know what? There's a crazy record. Like Urban Meyer as a coach has some ridiculous record against rivals. Like I'm talking about 15-1 or something. I mean, stupid. Even going back, he lost a couple times in Toledo when he was at Bowling Green, I think, or at least lost once. Maybe went one.
It's like me against San Jose State.
There you go. Same thing. But Harbaugh was brought in there to beat them. Beat Michigan State, beat Ohio State. Of all the games, I would say this. See if you agree with this. Let's stay with college football. Of all the games this year where the pressure is most on the coach, maybe in the last 10 years, it's Harbaugh against Ohio State. Because that's the only chance he has to wipe anything clean. The only chance. He's got to beat Ohio State this year. Period. No question.
And then if not, he gets his $8 million buyout.
See, here's my thing. But I actually contradicted myself there. And when I said it, I didn't like it. The real pressure, the life pressure, isn't on a guy making $9 million. Because of what
exactly.
The real pressure is when you're at Long Beach or I'm at Bowling Green. Because you get fired, hey, I don't know about you, but I wasn't making life-changing money at Bowling Green. I took a pay cut to go be a head coach. So that $9 million on top of what's already in the bank for Harbaugh, sure, he'll have to take some crap via media or via fans. But you know what you do with that $9 million? You move to Malibu where nobody cares, and they still remember you as a Stanford guy, and you do what Larry Brown did. You just live a nice life. So
Don Nelson,
go sell weed in Hawaii.
I mean, it's the way. Or you go into the media, cleanse yourself like Sarkisian, and then you're going to become a head coach.
I don't see Jim Harbaugh going on the staff of Nick Saban, but weirder things have happened, i.e. Lane Kiffin.
Yeah. I mean, and like everyone, first of all, if you work for Nick Saban and you're good at what you do, you're going to be a head coach at a very, very high level.
Right.
At a very high level. So, you know what? We've got a guest today. In fact, my phone just paying. I think, Taylor, you're going to call in Coach Billis?
Jay Billis, everybody.
Dockich, what's going on?
Billis, life is good, man.
I see you've come over to the dark side.
Oh, I had to. My wife called it a hoax.
Welcome to the club. It is so much easier. Life is so much easier.
You know what? Oh,
there it is.
A little wine, and a pandemic, and I woke up bald.
I'll tell you, he looks so much better. I mean, it's unbelievable. Not that you didn't look good before. No, the ponytail thing. Hey, I mean, the look before
was. Said, I said, man, I don't think this looks very good. She said, did you see your other look? I'm like,
it's a little bit of a Bruce Willis look.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, all right.
Well, you have your teeth in. If you took your teeth out.
Between us.
If you took your teeth out, I'm not sure. So, hey, Taylor, make sure we're recording this part of it because this is going to be as good. So we're trying to get a hold of Jay Billis. Jay, thank you very much for being with us. But you gave us the wrong Skype address, which I'm sure you don't use Skype a lot. That's fine. But then you gave us the correct Skype address, which was Billustrator. And our crack producer, the great Taylor, he goes, how do you spell it? Has to be the lowest point in the history of the Billustrator.
Well, I had to get that because there are all these fake accounts out there. And so I had to come up with something that nobody else would use. And that's what I did. But I don't know how to spell it either. Is it E-R or O-R?
Hey, Jay and Seth, speaking of fake accounts, I counted the other day, there were 14 fake Dan Dockett's whatever accounts.
I hate usually in front of them.
Yeah. How many fake ones you got out there, Jay? You know?
I don't know. I don't love myself that much to look it up or Google myself like that. But the great thing about the 14 fake Dan Dockett accounts is they're far more interesting than the real one.
Truthfully, I follow 15 people, myself and 14 other ones. So I love me some me, Jay.
Oh, man. All I know is I'm sure there are a lot of Seth Greenberg hates Duke, you know, Twitter accounts also.
Hey,
fake
Jay.
News. That's fake news.
Jay, let me ask you, because I'm asking everybody I see, you know, I do this, you know, nonsensical radio show, and people ask me all the time, hey, are we having college basketball? And my answer was always, yeah, we're going to figure this out. But then all of a sudden the news comes down that Orlando's been canceled, number of things. Now Fauci's saying this is going to be the worst December, all that kind of stuff. What's your take? What's your take on how the start, if the start of this season happens, and how the start of the season looks?
Dan, I think we're going to get it in. And again, I don't know anything about this other than the feel that I'm getting. And from the beginning, I felt like basketball was going to be the most likely to be compromised the season, simply because it's indoors during the wintertime, and there are far more games and far more travel and far more exposure opportunities. But what I'm hopeful of is we'll get started. We're going to be started by the time the overwhelming majority of schools are going to have sent their students home for Thanksgiving. And most of them aren't bringing them back until late January, maybe even into February, if at all, for the second semester. So there's an argument to be made that you know, basketball players may be safer on campus than anywhere else. So I'm hopeful we'll get it in, but I think the non-conference season is going to be really bumpy because of the different protocols. And then, you know, being right in the middle, like you said, of the height of this third wave, it's going to be incredibly bumpy when we get to January, February.
What was your first reaction when you heard
current update? Can I canceled? Give an update, please?
Oh, update. Yes,
there
yes,
are 40, 45 fake Jay Willis accounts. 45. There you go. Go ahead.
Kept me from looking it up after we hang up.
You don't get this everywhere. Like when you first heard that Orlando was canceled, what's the first thing that went through your mind?
I mean, a little bit of fear isn't the right word, but just sort of an unsettling feeling that, man, I was so hopeful of having some degree of a normal season because, I mean, I don't think I'm any different than you guys. Like, I just want to get back to work and I want to watch. We did a thing the other night. There was an NBA draft, like sort of combine workout for two players, Anthony Edwards and Tyrese Maxey. And I'm sitting in a studio in Charlotte watching this on television while we broadcasted it. And I was like unusually excited about working. And you know, I'm always pretty happy about it, but I was like, this is great. And maybe 2 years ago, I would have gone, oh, geez, I got to do this. But I can't wait to get back. So anything that provides a setback, you know, kind of gives you a little twinge in your stomach that, uh-oh, you know, what if I'm sitting at home during the wintertime? This is not a good thing.
He could even get a 2 minute sports edit hit right now and be happy with it.
Minute and a half would be better.
Don't extend the man, please. All right, so what have they told you? Because you're the commissioner of all things. You're the guy that, you know, everybody goes to. So what have you been told? What will happen in the preseason? Or is this all up in the air, even to you?
It's all up in the air to anybody. I don't think anybody really knows. Like, we've got things that are scheduled. I mean, you know, Dan, like, it was really funny. So when we were talking about the Champions Classic, that doubleheader with Michigan State, Kentucky, Duke, and Kansas, you know, people were talking about, well, where is it going to be? And one of the first things I said, well, why does it have to be in the same place? I mean, why would you bring four teams to one place for a doubleheader when there's no fans? And it looks like they are going to be played now on, you know, one home site, another home site. Like, what I think simplifying this is the way to go. So my view from the beginning has been, once we get to conference play, like, I live in ACC country. So, you know, the places in the southern footprint of the ACC, those schools, they should be playing each other more often because it's so much easier. Like, Syracuse flying to Miami, playing the Hurricanes and flying home doesn't seem like it's efficient to me in today's day and age. Like, I would, if they got to fly down to the Triangle, play on one road trip, play Duke, Carolina, Wake, and Clemson all in one shot, or play Florida State and Miami in the same road trip, or stay up north and play all those ACC schools. We're going to have to get more creative to get these games in and to have a decent schedule by the time we get to March Madness.
That's the reason I asked you, because I'm sitting here and I'm preaching every day, even non-conference. You know why? Sure. You got, in my area, I live in Indianapolis, and you got Indiana, you got Purdue. I mean, you got Evansville, you got Xavier, you got Cincinnati. I mean, you can run yourself. And the Indiana Sports Corp here, the group that puts on the Final Four and actually the Super Bowl, you know, I'm friends with those folks and they're dying to have everybody here. That to me is what it should look like, because as you said, all right, what sense does that make to do anything other than play people by you? Now, in a conference, maybe you got to, maybe by January we got this figured out, maybe there's a vaccine, I don't know. Do you think those things will happen? Meaning, do you think non-conference schedules that are yet to be determined will end up that way? Or do you think it's going to be, we're going to play one team here, one team there, like we always have?
I mean, the short answer is, I don't know. I mean, there are so many contracts that have to be dealt with, and you got these schools or teams that were relying upon a money game, and then the rug's getting pulled out from under them. The game's not going to be played. You got differing COVID protocols by conference. And all these are important and complicated issues. So I think Seth said it earlier on, like, you know, the NCAA has got to loosen up all of its restrictions and just say, look, you guys use your best judgment and go figure it out, because we're, you know, these MTEs, multiple team events and all that stuff, you know, they should take off all the restrictions. If three teams in the same conference want to play in the Maui Invitational, go ahead. Like, we gotta do some different things here while this is going on, because and this is where I'm going to surprise you guys. I think, you know, I'm usually on my high horse on top of a soapbox about, you know, about amateurism, all that stuff. But this is not the time for that argument. It's not the time to say, okay, you said no bubbles, now it's in a bubble, therefore they're pro. No, like, look, they're pros anyway, but let's put them, let's do what's right for the business, and let's do what's right to get the season in, because there's a lot riding on this, and that's okay. Let's not let optics carry the day here. Let's do what's the best for the enterprise, and not argue over that stuff here.
Having said that, Jay, like, you talk about bubbles, I like the idea of pods. You could legitimately, because you're saying, like, school's not going to be back in session probably till the middle of February at best. You could actually, over like an 8-day period, put four teams in a pod, play six games, play those games in one site, come home, practice a couple of days, do what you have to do, test everyone, then create another pod where everyone's just rotating pods, and you could legitimately get 18 games in probably a month and a half in league play.
Hey, let me ask both of you, how does that work in the world of ESPN televising? Just where the pod is, go bring your truck?
Probably helps.
Probably.
Saves money probably because you have it. And most of these places, like Jay, you guys do more games, but most of these places have control rooms anyway on campus now.
Yeah, the bigger conferences do. So if it were played on campus, I don't think pivoting for, you know, these media companies, ESPN included, to that kind of thing would be that difficult because we got to figure out the inventory no matter what. I just like the idea of look, if all these teams are going to be online education, and all of them are, what difference does it make whether they're sitting in a local hotel or they're sitting in a hotel further away in a bubble? They can still go to school and play, and they can, and that way they're safe. They can get all this stuff in. Look, you guys know this better than I do. It's not just like the season and television that's riding on this. There are so many jobs that are dependent upon this industry that we've built, and we can argue over should it have been done this way, or how do we do this or that in the context of higher education. But we've done it, and we can't just let it sink because this is going to be difficult or somebody's going to get their nose out of joint. It's too important. And football, for better or worse, football's done a pretty good job of figuring it out. And now could we, and especially like the high horse soapbox, me, sit here and say, like the Rutgers president said, you shouldn't be asking us why we're not playing football. You should be asking everybody else why they are. And you're going to find out in November and December why that's such a bad decision. And then a week, 10 days later, he votes. He's one of the unanimous votes to restart. We can drive a truck through the contradictions and the hypocrisy of all this. But you know what? It's important. And it doesn't, like, it's okay for us to try to do this and do it right. And if we fail, fine. But I would feel a lot worse if we didn't try.
What do you think this is going to do to mid-major basketball? Because I think do you think this could be the beginning of the end of one division, Division 1A basketball?
I think it makes the path to a super division clearer because I don't think this is like breaking news to anybody. The chasm between the Power Five and a few others and everybody else is so vast that, you know, we're placing everything, you know, all these hopes on, you know, can one of these smaller schools with no resources pull an upset in the NCAA tournament, or look what Gonzaga did, you know, 25 years ago. Those are pipe dreams. And do I think that there should be a super division? Yes. And I think it would be so much better for the game. People think that's elitist. But I think what it would do is you would have all the best players would want to play in that top division. So you would have more talent spread over fewer units, and you'd have more quality depth on these teams, and it would be a better product. You wouldn't have to worry as much about transfers or guys going pro, devastating your school. But if you're a smaller conference, you're going to feel like, hey, we're being left out, and this is a big part of our money-making ability and our ability to advance the institution through athletics. And those are major concerns.
But they could decide to conduct their business the way the super conferences would conduct their business. Like, you know, Gonzaga and the Big East, they're going to conduct their business just like they do in the ACC, the Big Ten, the Big 12. I mean, the NCAA tournament could remain whole, and the other institutions would just have to decide how they're going to conduct their business. Don't you think that would happen?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So like if we did have a super division or the big shots break off and form their own tournament, they could still invite anybody they wanted. And, you know, you still have the Cinderella aspect of the tournament, if you will, but sort of the conducting regular season business might be different, kind of like it is in football. I mean, I don't hear any fans crying over, well, Alabama doesn't give Charleston Southern a chance.
Right.
You know, they want to see the big shots play the big shots. And the truth is, like the games that we all played in and coached in back in the day, where they were, you know, Indiana or Virginia Tech or Duke versus little directional school, the fans back then went to those games. But they wanted to see something different. And now they're not going to those games like they used to. They're not consuming them like they used to. So I think the business has to pivot. But if you're one of those smaller schools, you're kind of going, well, wait a minute, that's going to leave us out in the cold. And I get it. But when we're arguing over how big this has gotten, and we talk about choice, like the players have a choice. They don't have to play college basketball if they don't want to. But what about the choice of the schools? Like, if you don't want to compete on the level of the Power Five, then, you know, you can go into Division II or Division III, where everything's in line with the state admissions of the universities and salaries are in line. You know, like if Ohio State doesn't want to do this anymore, they can play Amherst at the Shoe for free admission and no television. I don't think they're going to do that, but that choice is available to them.
You know, it's funny. I had a president at Bowling Green, one of my first years, we were having lunch. And he said, what do you think? I said, why is Bowling Green football Division I? And he said, it shouldn't be. You know, he said, it really shouldn't be. He said, you know, we're hemorrhaging money, 18 sports on a minimal budget. So I see both sides, but I totally get what you say. And Mercer beats Duke in the NCAA tournament and then plays Michigan State. Truthfully, I'd rather see Duke play Michigan State than Mercer. It's a great night. So I'm on both sides. Who's your number one pick in the draft?
I like Edwards. I mean, there's no like sort of obvious answer to that. I like Anthony Edwards at Georgia. He's a freak athletically and very, very gifted. He's still learning how to play. And, you know, it's funny, Dan, like, and Seth, when if we were talking 20 years ago or 30 years ago when we were, you know, we were kind of active in this stuff, about a 22-year-old kid like Edwards. Like, Edwards is 19. If we were talking about a senior with Edwards' ability, it would be okay with us that he struggled picking up concepts on defense as a freshman, or maybe didn't play every play as a freshman. Now it's like a death sentence if the guy took a playoff. And he's still going to get a lot better, and I think he's the best prospect. But I don't discount how good James Wiseman is. It's just James Wiseman would have been the number one pick 10 years ago. But I think the game has changed such that a big guy is probably not going to get that position right now at number one.
How much do you think NBA organizations look at, like, say, a guy like Cassius Winston or Xavier Tillman, an older guy, quote unquote, 21, 22 years old? How do you think the NBA people look at those guys? And do you think those guys don't get evaluated on potential, yet they're only 21, 22 years old? Like, that's one of those things that just blows my mind. They look at a guy at 22 and say, oh, man, okay, he's 22. He's been to college 3 years.
No, I think they do, and especially since you've had so many players that have played big roles. Yeah. They may not be the star of their team, but they've played big and important roles because of their versatility, the fact they know how to play, they know how to win, they can blend with great talent. I don't know whether you pick out a Draymond Green or something like that. Like, for Cassius Winston, I think offensively he fits in really well in the NBA. He'll do really, but his defensive liabilities are real. And so that's got to be factored in. So being maybe a late first round pick is the right place for him. The type of player that I think is really going to be interesting in this draft are guys that are not, don't have the superstar potential of an Anthony Edwards, perhaps, or maybe, you know, what, like, Mike Schmitz thinks LaMelo Ball is the most talented. He and I kind of differ a little bit on that. But guys like Sadiq Bey from Villanova, ooh, or Devin Vassell of Florida State, they're going, man, these guys do everything, and they're going to help somebody win. You know, like, who thought, like I didn't think, I thought Tyler Hero was one of the best shooters coming out in the draft he came out in. I didn't think he would be that good that fast. I don't know who did. You know, 13 teams passed on him before he got drafted, but look what he's done now. But then I think too about that. You guys tell me what you think about this. If he got drafted by Sacramento, would we be talking about how good he is right now? And I think the answer would probably be no. So part of it's where you get drafted and how things go for you.
I think that's the biggest part of it. And I use Duncan Robinson sitting at my house. Even my son were college roommates. He's at my house 2 years ago just hanging out. And if you'd have told me he would have impacted the NBA playoffs, are you kidding me? I mean, there's no NBA. Yeah, maybe as a video guy, you'd have impacted the NBA. Right? know. But no, you're right. What I look at Wiseman, I want to get back to him for just 1 second. I know the game has changed. What's a negative, other than the fact that he's, you know, they don't utilize a big guy like that. What's a negative about him? I don't know him well.
I didn't see him enough.
What's a negative on James Wiseman?
The only negative is you haven't seen as much of him. So there's a little bit of a mystery in it. And then the fear factor of, like, I feel like I'm caught a little bit in an old school mentality where all things being equal, you go with a big guy. And I've made some mistakes in evaluating players based upon that in the past. So I worry sometimes, am I shying away from that now and making a mistake on the other side of that spectrum? He's like ridiculously talented. And I think he's a great kid. Like, he's unbelievably smart, you know, speaks Chinese. I mean, he's engaging. There was something that was said recently. I think he was on Woj's podcast and had said something about the NCAA issue that he went through. And look, that issue was handled well by the NCAA. That was right in their wheelhouse.
What?
It was. That was. The rule was violated. They handled, like, you may not like the rule or whatever, but they handled it well. But when he quit and kind of walked away, he had said something of, like, remember how much coverage there was of that. I mean, yeah. We were all constantly on the air talking about it. And you know, it's a legal fight. It was really bizarre. And so when he quit, he had said something about, you know, it was a dehumanizing thing for him. And I kind of thought about that, going, look, the rule was properly applied. The NCAA did everything they were supposed to do. Memphis didn't handle it as well as I thought they should have. They made some mistakes in how they dealt with it. But the kid was the one kind of caught in the middle on that thing. And you know, maybe there's a better way to handle that, because ultimately he quit. And who is that good for? And now he's dealing with that. And then the pandemic sets everything back even further. So nobody's seen him in forever, but I think he's going to be a Chris Bosh type of talent in the NBA. I buried the lead there, but I think he's that kind of player.
I agree. I think he has a chance to be, like, he's got agility. Now, you know, obviously he's got to learn to play hard all the time, but, you know, every level you go up, you got to learn to play hard all the time, or, you know, he's got to get stronger, but he's skilled. He can run, he can guard ball screens. He can make a shot. I think the guy is really good. Let me, you know, we talk about the NCAA just real quickly, because you and I had a conversation the other day, and I heard you talk about the transfer rule. Now, again, right now, every transfer, it seems like almost every transfer is getting a waiver. But your take on the transfer rule was a little different, because I heard you say the other day something like you would just like to see consistency in it one way or another, that there really is no set protocol on waivers, who gets a waiver, who doesn't get a waiver. And then, like, we're going to have guys now this coming year that are going to be fifth-year guys that are going to be able to come back to school. Everyone's going to get the year back. How do you think that's going to impact college basketball?
I just, on the transfer rule itself, on the policy, and I think there are a number of coaches out there that are friends of mine that think that, you know, I want everybody to be eligible right away and, you know, to have the system turned upside down. Then we're going to have poaching of players and recruiting off rosters, and it's going to be dogs and cats living together. It's going to be horrifying. I just want it to be based on a principle and a consistent principle. So, for example, the year in residence where you transfer and you have to sit out a year, that's been around forever. It was based upon when you transfer to a new school, is back when there was freshman ineligibility. You know, like, you need to get used to your new school. Well, if a freshman doesn't have to get used to their new school and they can play right away, why would a transfer who's got college experience need to sit out? It's being used now as essentially a penalty or a disincentive to transfer. And it's not based upon a principle anymore. And I know, I think both of you have said, and I don't disagree, that there's not a better opportunity for a player to get better, to mature, than to sit out a year and take that year for development and all that. That's great. But if that were an accepted principle, then people wouldn't apply for waivers like they do. Like, the coaches want those guys to play right away. They need them right away. And the players want to play right away. That's available for them to sit out. The last part of it is, we can't have a transfer rule that applies to only five sports. like there are five sports where you transfer and have to sit out a year, and everything else you're immediately eligible. That doesn't make any sense. And it makes it seem like competitive balance is important only in these sports, and the rest of you do whatever you want because we don't really care about competitive balance in your sport. Well, their sport's every bit as important to them, and the coaches having their roster set is every bit as important to them as basketball, football, baseball, women's basketball, that stuff. So I'd be fine if people sat out if there was a reason, if there's a coherent academic reason for it, have them sit out. That's fine. But everybody's got to do it, and it's got to be based on a principle. The sitting out part is not a problem. My problem with the whole waiver thing is, like, most of what I hear in the waiver process and I see when I look into it is when a school will not support a player's waiver, it's usually based upon they're pissed off at the player because he's leaving, or they believe that somebody tampered with the player, another coaching staff tampered with their player. So they can't prove that there's any tampering. They think it is. And so the one that pays the price for it is the player. And my thing's always been the coaching profession needs to figure out what ethics are and what they're going to enforce against one another and leave the players out of it. So if you think that Dokić tampered with one of your players to get him to transfer, you need to be able to go to the coaches association, file a grievance against Dan, have that decided there. You can't just, like, I don't think it works where, you know, you guys are pissed at each other. And so the player winds up, you know, holding the bag on it and nothing happens between you guys. That just doesn't make any sense to me. And it never has.
Yeah. I look at it a little differently. Number one, when kids transfer, every single kid I've ever had, both at Indiana and at Bowling Green, that transferred didn't know it at the time. But they look back now as I talk to them, they're like, man, the greatest year I ever had was. So kids get waivers because they don't know what they don't know many times. In terms of the coaching thing, I guess I give players a little more credit and their families a little more credit for being sneaky. Because this has been my experience is that, the answer is, well, you should have done a better job with the player, and that's fine. But when people tamper, I always thought that it was my job as a player to say, get the hell out of here. You know, I'm at this school. Because opening that door allows the tampering to come in. Like people at Illinois got mad at Calvin Sampson for poaching Eric Gordon. Well, Eric Gordon doesn't get poached if Eric Gordon's dad said, look, we're committed to Illinois. And period. Don't call. What are you calling me for? I'm committed to Illinois. I have a big problem with football coaches that stand there like they're military generals all the time trying to flip a recruit from a 17-year-old. But that's my thing with players. I think you give players – you're more player-centric in terms of believing the goodness of players. I'm more player-cynical in not believing any of the goodness of players or any of the people around them. I think that there needs to be some type of, I don't know if punishment's the right word, but some type of protection for a coach and a university, particularly in a guy's third or fourth year. Like, I'll tell you one thing I did, Jay. I had two kids come in. One kid came in after we had, I had raised money for him to go on an overseas trip. And he wanted to transfer. I said, that's great. You're going to pay me that money back. You're going to pay me the money that I raised. Now, you may agree with that or disagree. I had another kid. He ended up being the leading scorer in the NCAA tournament on August 9th after I paid for all his summer school. He got tampered with, left Bowling Green, went to Ohio State, Ron Lewis. I said, that's great, but I'm not letting you go until you pay me back the summer school money that I had to raise. I literally had golf outings. And I said, look, you told us you were coming. You told us you were staying. We paid you X amount of dollars. You pay that money back, I'll let you go. No problem. That may be right or wrong, but at some point you feel like you got to protect your basketball program a little bit. You know?
No, I get it. And those are real, like real human emotions. And it comes, you know, trust.
To me,
and
that's real finances.
That's true too. Yeah. That's true too. But my point, my issue with that has always been the idea of, that's where the player is looked upon as an asset, and they're the school expects, or the coach, the team expects a return on the investment. So, and I understand that feeling, But that's not the way the players treated by the enterprise, by the industry. And, you know, we say that they're students to be treated like any other student, and the scholarship is not pay. It's an academic opportunity. And so when I get pushback on the compensation issue, people say, well, they already get paid. They get a scholarship, they get a stipend, they get all this other stuff. And, you know, my response oftentimes is, all right, well, athletes aren't the only ones who get scholarships. So if, you know, a full ride to a non-athlete, is that pay? Like, how do we determine that? I get it. Like, you know, I hear that a lot. You know, your point about, well, the kid waited till the end of summer school to decide to transfer. We can put in reasonable rules as to when you have to notify and all that stuff. I just think if the guy, you know, the player's gone anyway, what good does it do to make him sit out? And my thing, and I know I'm getting off on a tangent on this one, but, you know, how many players in basketball do we see transfer at Christmas, you know, at the holiday break, because they can be eligible the second semester of the following year? My thing would be, look, let them be eligible the following year no matter what. But that way, the school that they ultimately may transfer from, they get a year of service out of the player, and they get more time to work it out with them. I just don't see how we can have amateurs that are having penalties to move around when no other student has that. I think NIL is going to help that. I think if you're making some money at the school you're at, you're less likely to leave, you know, what you're earning, unless you got something a heck of a lot better somewhere else.
I think the interesting thing's going to be this year with these kids all getting the year back. There's going to be a massive number of transfers because, this is like a free year for all these players. So I think it's going to be really interesting how that evolves. I think some of the coaches, and, you know, I know you talked to his and some other guys, think that fighting through, it's easy to take that path out the door. But sometimes you've got to fight through some adversity, and that fight through that adversity helps you appreciate not only where you are, but where you arrive to. You know, and that adversity is part of kind of the journey. Like, let me ask you, I mean, like, you had an incredible experience at Duke. Were there times, like, when you were at Duke, whether it was when Coach K was talked about maybe not being renewed, or, you know, maybe when, like, he was jumping your ass to the point where, like, holy, I mean, like, the old man's killing me, that you thought for a second, man, why am I putting up with this bull? And a person with maybe less guidance or support or, you know, competitive spirit would just run from it. Where, like, obviously it worked out pretty good for you to get through those tougher times. We've all been through tough times in the course of our playing, my minimal playing career. You two guys are real players. But you know what I'm saying? I mean,
I know exactly what you're saying. And of course, there were times when you know, you had rough periods where it came through your mind, you know what, I'm out of here. But you know, those things didn't last for very long.
Right.
I mean, there are some instances, and I don't know what the percentages are. Is it half or what? Yeah. Some instances where the transfer is the right thing for the player.
Yeah.
And you know, not all transfers are just, you know, players that had a bad day and they decide I'm going to leave because I don't want to face adversity. You know, is it teaching them a lesson when they have no choice but to face the adversity? I don't know the right answer.
Yeah.
The other part of it is, like, in a transfer situation, I find it kind of difficult logically to wrap my head around that, you know, we tend to say that the player, you know, like to Dan's point about they don't know what they don't know when they're making a transfer decision. They've got college experience. They've been through it a little bit. But they need to be bound by the decision they made when they were in high school with no college experience. You know, that's a tougher one for me to sort of justify. Mm-hmm. And like to your point about, you know, I'm a little bit more pro player. I think that's true. You know, I think on a decision whether to stay or go, you have to err toward the side of the player. And even there was one other thing on the transfer thing, like making the player sit out. I understand kind of why we, you know, we sort of, I don't want to say cherry pick, but we pick different reasons why sitting out is the right thing. But there also, sometimes I look, oh, do we want these guys playing when they're 24? You know, even if they're not going to be pros, I mean, you know, that's kind of what we're looking at with some of these guys. They get in older now because they've been held back for athletic reasons. So they start school at 19. And if they wind up taking a red shirt or a transfer year in residence thing, I mean, some of these guys are 23, 24 years old when they finally get out. And I don't know that that's the right thing either. There's just a lot of competing interests here.
Oh man, Pat Knight was 32 years old, man. Are you kidding me? And I'm like, Coach, man, what do you want him playing when he's got three kids and you're a grandpa? Redshirt high school year. You know, hey, can you clear something up for the world? Because you are the guru of all things. Why does it take so long for the NCAA to make – I get this all the time, and your opinion. Why does it take so long for the NCAA to come down on schools like Arizona, like LSU, that type of thing? Why does it take so long?
Well, I mean, in this one thing, as you know, having the FBI and the Southern District of New York involved, the NCAA kind of stood down and let them go forward. So that delayed everything quite a bit. I'm sure the pandemic's had something to do with it. So there are legitimate reasons why it has been slow in these instances with regard to the ones that were caught up in this thing. I will tell you the thing that frosts me more than anything is the schools themselves. So look, I don't want to cast aspersions on anybody and pick out one school over another, but I will tell you a couple things. If I were the AD or the president at some of these prominent schools caught up in this, I would not need the NCAA to tell me I needed to make a change. And I do not want to hear from some of these places the word integrity. Like, don't lecture me on integrity, because clearly you do not understand the meaning of that word. And like, you know, there are instances where you're going, okay, what do you need? Do you need like to open their trunk and have a dead body in there? Or like, so you think all this stuff was made up, all of it. And you know, the reporter that broke the story made it up. Okay, that was inaccurate. That was wrong. That was fake news. The Southern District of New York and the FBI got it wrong. That was all fake. The lawyers who subpoenaed Will Wade and Sean Miller to the trial in the Southern District of New York, they've taken an oath as officers of the court. And they and what were they doing? Like this A Few Good Men thing where Tom Cruise brings in a couple of the guys, yeah, that were, you know, that were saw the plane come in and it was all fake. That's a fraud on the court. So they're in on it. This is all nonsense. Like, these schools know what happened, and they're unwilling to do what has always been the right thing in their jobs. And I don't want to listen to those guys anymore. I've had enough of that stuff.
Did you not listen to the world's greatest rant last week on the world's greatest podcast? I mean, I know you listen to other podcasts, but on the world's greatest podcast last week, Dan Dockich had a, I don't know what, 5, 10? How long was the rant?
I don't know, but Jay, I'm so with you on this. And
come on. Let's go. Give us the Cliff Notes version.
You got to get me frosted, and I'll be going. But Sean Miller, all right, let's just say it's about winning, okay? He's a great coach, and we want to win. He's the only dude that can win at Arizona. Like, nobody else can win at freaking Arizona. He's the only guy. Freaking Will Wade, you know, what they've drawn, 2,000 people in a 12,000. It drives me bat blank crazy, Jay and Seth, that exactly what you said. I don't want to hear from some AD now talking about integrity, just like I said about the football coaches. I don't want to hear about integrity from football coaches when they stand up there. And basketball coaches probably, they don't do it as much. But football coaches stand up there about integrity, and this is, you know, Duke week, and we're going to come out and you know, we're a general and we're going to wear our camouflage and all the crap that college football does. And while in the meantime, their assistant coaches are trying to flip an 18-year-old kid on the commitment. That whole stuff drives me bat blank. And I'm so with you on this. I don't want to hear about integrity from any of those schools, because let me tell you something. You can go hire somebody else and they're going to win at Arizona. They just are. They're going to win it. Urban Meyer told me when he went to Ohio State, he goes, look, he goes, everybody that's hired at Ohio State football wins 75% of their games. That's what it was. Now, he took it to a higher level, but that's drives me crazy. Drives me freaking crazy, Jay.
And you want to ask, like Dan and Seth, you want to ask these professionals, you know, the administrators, like, what are you afraid of?
Right.
Like, are you afraid they're going to sue you for wrongful termination? Let them sue you, because I would love to sit everybody down for deposition, start asking some questions under oath, and get all their records and all that stuff. I would love that. And part of me would welcome that. Look, I understand the LSU dilemma a little bit more. Haven't been down there. Like when this all broke and Will Wade was suspended because he wouldn't cooperate and Tony Benford took over as the interim head coach, the LSU fan base was basically saying, really? Like, so we get good, and now all of a sudden we gotta do that. Like, let's just keep going, and if something happens, we'll vacate the games later. Schools in our league have been cheating like crazy for years, and we're the ones that have to step forward and say, we did it. Sorry, I got that. And the administrators are going, well, geez, if we do something here, we're gonna have to wear flak jackets into work and get Secret Service protection. I understand that. But at some of these other places, I don't understand like how they can with a straight face say that, well, we believe in integrity and we believe in running a culture of compliance. Like, oh, shut up. Like, stop saying that because it's clearly not true.
Jay, they fired the AD at LSU. Like the AD gets fired and the coach is still out there. So, hey, look, at least you know where they stand and good for them, I suppose. I don't know. It drives me bat blank crazy.
What else? But then the NCAA, like to your point before, like now the NCAA, and this is where I have a little bit of a problem with the way this is being handled. So Oklahoma State has an assistant that gets caught up in this stuff. It's basically proven that there was no competitive advantage gain. Nobody knew about it, all that other stuff. And they got hit with a bag of hammers over the smallest aspect of this thing. And I believe that groundwork is being laid through that so that they can say, we're serious. So get ready, the rest of you, because you're going to get this times 10. I don't think that's the right way to handle things. I think you do the reasonable thing in each case. But look, I'm flabbergasted that it's taken this long. And that fan bases and the like are essentially making excuses like this stuff did not happen. I made the analogy the other day, and I hope people don't take it the wrong way. But back in the day when the O.J. Simpson case was decided, I was fine with somebody telling me, you know what, the prosecution did not prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt. That's reasonable. Like that's a reasonable position to take. I didn't want to hear anybody tell me, you know what, he didn't do it. Yeah, he did. Yeah, he did. And it's the same thing here. Don't tell me they didn't do it. Now, if you want to tell me the NCAA didn't make their case or the Southern District of New York had the wrong, an improper theory of the case and it needs to be overturned on appeal, fine. Let's argue the legal technicalities. Don't tell me they didn't do it because they did.
So how does this new process, this new NCAA process, that they're bringing in the outside group to do the investigation, to do the follow-up, to actually administer the protocol of determining the outcome of the allegations. How will that, what effect will that have? And does that just give the universities a better opportunity to lawyer up?
Well, they've got that opportunity no matter what. I mean, it's so NCAA. You know, they name this new sort of complex case unit the Independent Accountability Resolution Process, and you're the IARP, and you're like, really? You couldn't come up with a better name for that? It's just not that difficult. The unknown of this, and it's nothing but unknowns, is one, there's no appeal from any decision. I don't think that's that big of a deal because the NCAA like changed the appeal rules years ago where there's virtually no way to get anything rolled back on appeal anyway. But you don't know what this new process is going to bring. Is it going to bring, you know, more fairness? Is it going to be more stringent? Are the penalties going to be harsher? I have no idea, and I don't think anybody else does either. But they've been lawyering up forever, and sure. And that's another part of this process. You know, this was supposed to be. This is the NCAA Committee on Infractions and the enforcement process was supposed to be collegial. That's the idea behind it. It's supposed to be cooperative and collegial, and it's not. because if you're the one in the crosshairs of this thing, like most people are like us in sort of the NCAA realm, like whether they're at schools or whatever, they want harsh justice until they're the ones that go through the process. And then they go, wait a minute. This process I've been supporting all these years is horribly unfair. They don't like it when they're in it. And I had a talk with an AD recently of a smaller school that got hit with these like just incredible sanctions for some administrative error on the cost of books or something. And, you know, they got all these things vacated and all that. And the administrator was saying, I've always supported this process. But now there's a part of me, he goes, I won't do it because it's an integrity issue, but it's crossed my mind that if anything this small comes across my desk, we'll just fix it and not tell anybody. Like, why would we self-report this? It's like if we're speeding on the highway and going 5 miles over the speed limit, but no cop pulls us over, we go turn ourselves in and we're put in jail for 20 years. We probably wouldn't turn ourselves in if we knew that was going to happen. And that's the kind of system that it seems like we have right now, where the punishments don't fit the infraction, and that's not a good place for us to be.
Boy, I've thought that a long time, Jay. Every year, maybe twice a year. I think it's once a year. IndyStar lists all the self-reported violations for Purdue, Indiana. You know what I mean? Because it's public record. And I'm thinking to myself, man. Meaningless, 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 meaningless. But the headline screams, Indiana, 28 self-report. You know, I'm right. Thinking the yeah. Same thing as you. That is not worth it. Fix it and let's move forward. I'm so with that. God dang, because the headline, nobody reads the article.
Yeah.
They just read that Jay Bell, as head coach at Duke, had 28 self-reported violations. That's all anybody does. Well, you're
screaming. You know, the AD, they're doing that. Most of them are doing that just to cover their asses. Well, that's what they're doing. They're responsible to do it.
I would assume that's the only reason anybody would.
No, but you guys know. To do it.
But that's a great point. Like, you guys know this. Like, so all these institutions have these, it's like a compliance industry now. Oh. They spend all this money on compliance. So it's almost like tax returns. Like, they want to report a certain amount of what yeah, used right. to be called secondary violations that are now yeah. level three because it shows the NCAA that our compliance apparatus is working. Look, yeah. we found all these little, so they want to have those violations. Yeah. And that way, if they didn't report anything, the NCAA would be going, hey, wait a minute, we need to go in there and start digging around because they haven't reported anything. There's no way that you can live under this draconian set of rules and not have violations. So if they don't report anything, clearly they're doing something wrong. And that's the system we've created. It's sort of a Rube Goldberg crazy system. And look, I believe in rules. Like, I'm not saying, you know, don't wear a seatbelt or this is America. How can anybody tell me? Rules are important, but they have to be reasonable rules and based on solid policy, and they have to be reasonably enforced and reasonable adjudication.
It's like a cop has to give so many tickets out for a month or whatever the deal is, or else you're not doing your job.
Yeah.
The industry of compliance is off the charts. All right, who's your best team? Give me your couple best teams coming into the season, assuming we have one.
I like Villanova, Michigan State. I like Gonzaga, Iowa. I think the Big Ten is going to be the best league, oof. And I'm not sure it's going to be even close. And that's going to be where I think it's going to be the most fun to watch how that thing shakes out, because I think it's got Monster League written all over it. But yeah, and I mean, a lot of it'll be usual suspects. Frankly, Baylor is going to be outstanding. The teams that are older or like normal are going to do better, and then the you know superstar freshman teams are. We're going to have to wait till the end to see if they've got enough gas in the tank they're going to have extraordinarily good freshmen to win in this environment, I think. And it's going to be even harder. I sometimes worry about like how, not worry, but like I've been looking at this year, like how are these teams, you're going to have some maturity to handle all that's coming at you this year. And I think teams can be mentally, sort of their mental health toward the end of the season can be compromised. Not that they're going to need to be in a rubber room or anything, but they're going to be unusually mentally fatigued at the end of this year. So I think older, more experience is even more helpful this year.
I think, you know, that's important because teams have not been together. But I'll tell you what's going to be important. Tell me if you guys agree with this or not. I think how the head coach deals with the uncertainty of the season, the setbacks, the delays, the cancellations, the contact tracing. If you have a head coach that reacts to each and every time they have a roadblock or a detour, that team will take on that personality. And I think that coaches are going to have to be really poised and really patient and really respectful of the protocol, because once they start pushing back, one, they're going to look like these football coaches that think that, you know, they have all the answers. But more importantly, I think what's going to happen is your team's going to take on your personality, and they're going to overreact to every single setback. And that's going to impact any team's chance of continuing to get better during the tougher time. Because I think the mental health aspect and the uncertainty of when you're going to start to play, when you're not, how many games you're going to have to sit out, are you going to be quarantined? All of a sudden, now all of a sudden we have a schedule. No, now all of a sudden we're playing in pods. Now all of a sudden, you know, we have a week off. Let me tell you something. I think that how that head coach handles that will determine any chance. And a guy is like a roller coaster and up and down every time there's a setback. I think that team will have no chance of being there at the end.
One of the hardest parts is going to be our job when we're sitting courtside and the coach is wearing a mask and we don't get to read their lips when they're reaming out an official. I think that's a horrible downside of this pandemic. Like some of the coaches, I think they're wearing masks will help the beautification of the game.
Yeah.
Have their face covered up. But I would like to be able to read lips. That's one of my favorite parts.
Your guy was ahead of the curve by putting his hands over his mouth, right? He was, once again, Coach K, ahead of the curve, baby. Hey, Jay, thanks, man. Appreciate your time today.
That was fun.
Great stuff.
And I'll tell you what, Dan, the new look, welcome to the dark side of going completely. Like Scott Van Pelt was the one that told me, he goes, brother, it's time to surrender. Like, just surrender. And I did it.
I had my listeners say, come home, Dan. Come home.
Hey, you look years younger. And by the way, okay. you had a bad rap, by the way. You had a bad rap around with little stuff at the bottom. Hey, it was not a good look.
It was almost Al LaBalbo like. It was getting Al LaBalbo.
when finally all the wine set in, and I said, look, my stepson was going to shave it. I go, I want to shave down this line right here to see how much hair I had. And I got it. And I'm like, that's it? What the hell's that?
Hey. You can always grow your eyebrows longer and comb them back. That's my next move.
That was Coach Lowe.
Jay, this is true, man. Coach Knight, Randy Whitman told me when I was a freshman, he goes, hey, man, stare at Coach Knight when he's yelling at you, because I swear to God, his eyebrows grow when he yells. He used to pop. Oh, man. Thanks, Jay.
Good being with you guys, as always. All right.
Man, that was a lot of fun with Jay Billis. Hey, everybody, stay safe out there. We want to have a college basketball season. This is the world's greatest podcast. Rate us a 5, please, as you know. We deserve it. Wherever you get your podcast, whether it's Spotify, iTunes, wherever.
Oh, by the way, Dan, just I don't want to interrupt you, but you know what? Starting next week, we are going to start previewing different leagues, giving you insight into who's good, who has a chance to be good, the best players, maybe the best games. So stay tuned. We're talking hoop. We're talking games. We're talking leagues starting next week.
Thank you for listening to Courtside with Greenberg and Dockage. You can listen and subscribe to all ESPN podcasts in the Listen tab of the ESPN app, including the latest from the NBA and the Hoop Collective podcast, available in the ESPN app or Apple Podcasts.